I call the Senate Resources Committee to meeting to order. Today is Monday, April 15th, 2024. The time is 3:31 p.m. Please turn off your cell phones. Oops, I better check mine. Yes, okay. Members present, Senator Clayman, Senator Dunbar, Senator Kaufman, Vice Chair Senator Wilikowski, and Co-Chair Senator Bishop. I'm Senator Giesel. Excused today is Senator Kawasaki. We have a quorum to conduct business. Thank you, Sav and Dylan, for supporting the committee functioning today. We have two items on the agenda, Senate Joint Resolution 19, supporting certain U.S. trade policies by the Senate Resources Committee, and a presentation from the Department of Natural Resources on next generation mineral assets in Alaska. First up is Senate Joint Resolution 19. Supporting certain U.S. trade policies by the Senate Resources Committee. This is the first hearing of this resolution. We have a CS in front of us. Co-Chair Bishop.
Madam Chair, I move CS number. I move CS number 33-LS /1498/year from the committee.
Before the committee for, thank you. So, with that, the committee substitute for Senate Joint Resolution number 19, version 33-LS1498/S is before the committee. I am going to object for purposes of discussion. My staff is before us, Julia O'Connor, and she will explain the changes that were made in the CS.
Thank you. For the record, Julia O'Connor, staff to Senator Giesel. The Senate Resources Committee adopted the following changes. Updated the title as a technical change, and on page 2, line 12, to include Russia, along with China, as a focus of the resolution.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. O'Connor. Any discussion? All right. We have a presentation today. Invited testimony is Mr. Dave Banks. He is the managing director of Battle Group. He is online on Teams. And I'm seeing him up there. Mr. Banks, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Great. Welcome. If you would introduce yourself to the committee, name, affiliation, and give us your presentation related to this resolution.
Thank you so much, Senator, and good afternoon in Alaska. Before I begin, I would like to thank you, Chair Giesel, for the invitation to testify today in support of Senate Joint Resolution 19, which calls for a new federal trade policy to bolster U.S. competitiveness while weakening China's and Russia's influence in the global economy. I'd also like to thank Chair Bishop and the members of the committee for taking the time to attend and consider my testimony on this important issue. It's an honor and a privilege. My name is Dave Banks. I'm a Republican advisor and consultant on supply chain, energy, security, climate, and trade policy. While I have several affiliations with different D.C.-based organizations and think tanks, I'm here today speaking on my own behalf under my consultancy, Battle Group. I've served in several federal positions. I most recently worked as chief strategist for Republicans on the House Climate Committee. Before that position, I was President Trump's special advisor on international energy and environment policy. My other federal jobs included deputy staff director for Republicans on the Senate Environment Public Works Committee, a senior advisor on international climate policy for President George W. Bush, a State Department diplomat, and a CIA analyst. In my different capacities, I've often worked with the Alaska Congressional Delegation, including the offices of Senators Murkowski and Sullivan. I'm here today to talk about some of the big challenges facing America as we stare down the threat of Chinese and Russian aggression, as well as Alaska's role in helping address those challenges. I'm going to stress the need for a new federal trade policy that can help strengthen our competitiveness, increase our supply chain security, bolster our economy, and create good-paying jobs while holding major polluters like China accountable. It's my opinion that Alaska would be a major beneficiary of a new trade policy that values high environmental and labor standards. Very few folks produce energy and other natural resources as cleanly as Alaskans, and your industry can clearly serve as a model for the rest of the world. Now, reversing U.S. declining competitiveness in the global market is increasingly becoming a national priority. U.S. manufacturing output has fallen relative to foreign competitors, particularly since China's entry into the World Trade Organization, which has cost America roughly 3.4 million jobs. China became the world's top manufacturing economy in 2010, when it ended more than a century of U.S. dominance. Today, the country accounts for roughly 30% of global production, about double that of America. The Chinese Communist Party has pursued predatory trade practices to increasingly gain market share at our expense. In 2000, China's ranking as top importer won the high spot in only a few countries. By 2013, it had captured about 50. By 2021, it had gained the top importer rank in almost all of South America and Africa, reducing the once dominant global economic presence of America and its Western allies. On this matter, you can refer to slide 2, which shows the general pattern of China's expanding trade dominance, which has created growing dependency on the Chinese that in turn reduces U.S. and allied influence. I find it very disturbing when you look at how the red has spread from one map to the next and then to the next. Most importantly, from a social economic perspective, the loss of manufacturing has substantially reduced U.S. gateway jobs from the lower to the middle classes. While I'm not Alaskan, I grew up in one of the poorest areas in America, in rural Southeast Missouri, and I experienced firsthand the destruction of jobs because of naive trade policy embraced by Washington and corporate America. The reduction of job opportunities has had severe negative impacts on our poor, especially in rural areas, including on our health and increased vulnerability to drug and alcohol addiction. The relative decline of U.S. manufacturing certainly has had negative implications for America's supply chain security. This vulnerability stretches across key strategic sectors, including strategic and critical minerals. Given the potential important role that Alaska should play in bolstering related U.S. and allied supply chains, let's focus on this one aspect of Chinese policy. Now, China is wealthy in minerals, but not enough to meet its ambitious goal to dominate worldwide trade in minerals. In gaining global supremacy in mineral resource extraction and processing, China seeks to secure its role as the world's factory and expand the economic and political influence that standing provides, and in the process, increases its power and influence vis-a-vis America and its allies. Now, China has reinforced its edge in domestic mineral production by extending control of overseas mining interest, which has given it considerable control over the upstream global supply chain. It has achieved this result by leveraging its ability to absorb political and economic risk when funding projects in the developing world, including sub-Saharan Africa. And the next slide, by the way, has some data on sub-Saharan Africa. That would be too risky for the U.S. private sector. Chinese foreign economic policy has enabled it to capitalize fully on its decades-old strategy of investing in its own domestic processing, which has allowed China to create a dominant midstream market position. While China only produces 14% of the world's lithium, for example, it controls 80% of its refining. With cobalt, the number is 1% of global production and 64% of refining. And then with copper, China produces 9% of the world's output, but controls 37% of its refining. It gets worse. Because America lacks sufficient refining capacity, we must send most of our own raw material production to China for processing before they're used in manufacturing the technologies that require them. This creates a further comparative advantage for Chinese industry in the downstream part of the global mineral supply chain, the final process in the production and sale of goods to consumers. Again, slide 2 provides a few tables that illustrates China's dominance in strategic and critical minerals, including extraction and sub-Saharan Africa, which is becoming more and more strategic for America and for the world. At the same time, the current trade regime rewards bad performers like China, like Russia, and ignores the environmental superiority of American producers. Now, make no mistake, America is leading in reducing emissions, as you can see on slide 4. Between 2005 and 2020, we led the world in cutting CO2 emissions by far, falling 24% by 2020 and achieving more absolute ton reductions than the next several emissions-reducing countries combined. In contrast, China's CO2 emissions between 2005 and 2020 grew by 84%. Today, the level of Chinese emissions is almost 3 times that of ours. America is one of the cleanest economies in the world when it comes to the amount of carbon needed to produce any given product. A 2020 report published by the Climate Leadership Council found that U.S. manufactured products are 40% more carbon efficient than the world average. The average product made in China requires at least 3 times more carbon than in America. In Russia, that number is more than 4 times. Let's look at slide 5. America's carbon advantage cuts across all energy-intensive sectors, including ag, mining, refining, chemicals. Mining and other resource extraction activities, for example, are more than 2 times more carbon-intensive in China than in America. For mining support services, the gap is more than 5 times. So if we mine, if we extract resources in the United States, including Alaska, and displace dirtier production overseas, particularly from China, we actually reduce global emissions. Now, importantly, the greenhouse gas life cycle emissions of coal, natural gas, and oil vary by supplier, often significantly, as slide 6 illustrates. For example, Russian-produced natural gas shipped by pipeline to Europe has roughly 41% higher life cycle emissions than U.S. LNG shipped to the same destination. Russian-produced natural gas shipped by pipeline to China has 47% higher life cycle emissions than U.S. LNG exported to China. So that, by the way, the U.S. LNG exports are from the Gulf Coast. Those numbers would obviously be better if we had the data on the exports from Alaska.
Mr. Banks, could you yes. pause for a moment? So sure. You're speaking to the committee, of course, and we have slides in front of us. There's also the public that is listening to this, and will listen to the recording. The slides that you're citing are a little behind. So we're looking right now at slide number 9, which is titled 20-Year Life Cycle Emissions from Fossil Fuels, U.S. versus Competitors. Just FYI.
Oh, my apologies.
Yes. So I'm just trying to have my staff move the slides with your conversation, regardless of the number of the slide that you cite. So to the public who is listening, please keep just looking at the slides going forward. All right. I'll let you continue, Mr. Banks.
Thank you so much. Again, my apologies. In general, U.S., including Alaskan producers, would benefit from a policy framework that rewards environmental performance. Such an approach would drive efficiency gains across the global fossil fuel supply chain, encouraging industry to invest in advanced technologies and adopt best practices. And it would hold foreign competitors like Russia, like China, accountable. Again, current trade rules do not reward U.S. industry for its environmental performance. In fact, they do the opposite by rewarding poor environmental performers like China, like Russia, who use their poor records to generate a competitive advantage in trade and result in the offshoring of domestic jobs, undermining our country's socioeconomic mobility. To close, America and its allies have found themselves at a significant disadvantage with Chinese dominance in global trade and supply chains, upstream, midstream, and downstream. America must work to wrest control of critical supply chains from China and Russia. A new trade policy offers an opportunity to bolster U.S. economic and job security for countless Americans, all while reducing the influence of our adversaries in the global economy. That concludes my testimony. I thank you again to the chair, the co-chair, and the rest of the committee for the opportunity to speak with you today. And thank you so much for your consideration of Senate Joint Resolution 19 and the need to reset U.S. trade policy and reward U.S. industry for its environmental performance. I now look forward to answering any of the committee's questions as well as I can. Thank you.
Of course. Thank you. And I will just say, for procedural purposes, I need to remove my objection to adopting the committee substitute that that was just moved to be on the table. So, questions for Mr. Banks. Mr. Banks, could you then summarize the purpose of this resolution, just in like maybe five sentences?
Yes, and my apologies for not being able to see exactly who's asking the question.
It was me, the co-chair Giesel.
Yes. Thank you, Chair. So the purpose of the resolution would be to send, to essentially send a message, a request to the federal government to reset U.S. trade policy. And resetting U.S. trade policy, and by the way, there are a number of different policy options that can be pursued here. There's no specific policy that this resolution calls for, except for looking at a new trade policy that, again, would hold foreign polluters accountable and reward U.S. industry for its environmental performance.
Nice summary. Yes. Raising awareness of the carefulness which the U.S. places on environmental protection of our water, air, land. The other thing I would point out is that while Alaska has vast minerals, for to a large degree, we send those minerals to China for processing. When they cross the boundary of China, they become the possession of the Chinese government, who in turn can ban the further export of those same minerals that were mined in Alaska or other places in the U.S., so that we can't buy them back, or we have to pay quite a bit to buy them back. I think particularly of germanium and gallium, which were recently prohibited from export from China. Alaska produces, and my co-chair, Senator Bishop, who's actually a miner, by the way, if I'm not mistaken, gallium is produced at Red Dog Mine, along with our zinc. And it is one of those minerals that is banned from export now in China. Is that right, Co-Chair Bishop?
I believe you're correct.
Further questions or comments from committee members? Co-Chair Bishop, did you have any? All right. Yes, Senator Kaufman.
Just a comment. Through the chair, I just want to say I'm glad we're considering this. It's an important issue. I think folks have been blind to it for a long time. It's about time. Thank you.
Thank you. And I thank Senator Dunbar, who actually proposed the addition of Russia to this resolution, holding China, Russia, and other countries accountable. Any further discussion on the resolution? I will open public testimony now on this resolution. Is there anyone in the audience here in Juneau that wishes to testify on Senate Joint Resolution number 19? Seeing none, I see no one online wishing to testify either. I will close public testimony. All right. So, Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move to report committee substitute for SJR 19, Work Order 33-Lima Sierra 1498/Sierra out of committee with individual recommendations and attached zero physical note.
Thank you. Seeing no objection, the bill will be moved from committee. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the committee report and set up for the next item on the agenda. Resources is back on the record. The next item on our agenda today is the Department of Natural Resources presentation, Next Generation Mineral Assets in Alaska. So today I will welcome Melanie Worden. She is the Director of the Division of Geologic and Geophysical Surveys with the Department of Natural Resources, and John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. Welcome.
Thank you.
So you probably know the drill, but just identify yourself for the record, your affiliation, and go ahead with your presentation.
Okay. For the record, Melanie Worden, Director, DNR, Department of Natural Resources, Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys. And I'd like to thank the chairs and the committee for the invitation to give this presentation on next generation mineral assessments in Alaska. Okay, so looking at this map, you can see that different types of mineral systems define geographic belts. These are Alaska's mineral belts. They are areas where major ore-forming processes came together and they caused ore deposition at certain times in the history of the world. And so Alaska's mineral systems give us ideas, you know, based on global knowledge about what metals might be found where in Alaska, including critical minerals that might not have been considered in the past. Many of these mineral belts are on state land, and many of the belts include operating mines or major discoveries. These are the regions that DGGS, or Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys, is targeting for our data collection in the state.
Dr. Worden, as we move from slide to slide, would you announce the slide number? That way the folks online can follow along.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Okay, that was slide number 2. We're moving to slide 3. And from 2018 to 2023, the Alaska mineral industry's exploration expenditures were $1.23 billion. Their development expenditures were $2.16 billion, and the total mineral production value was $18.36 billion. This is a large sector in Alaska's economy. This talk is about how DNR can facilitate future mineral exploration, which will help industry make new discoveries and move exploration projects up the pyramid to become mines. And slide 4. Modern prospecting is really data driven. And so industry starts the exploration process by first compiling all publicly available geoscience data. Then they process this data in many ways and clean it up. Then they apply artificial intelligence and machine learning techniques. They make sure that the artificial intelligence results they get make sense. And then they use the resulting prospectivity map to locate and field test targets. Going out in the field is very expensive, and so this is the way to be more cost effective with your approach to exploration. So slide number 5 now. It is really going to be a technology-driven exploration future. Alaska is set to gain major long-term benefits from next-generation data gathering about our mineral potential. The more data we provide, the more exploration and potentially more development we can expect in Alaska. Exploration is driven by many factors, but 3 of the main ones are new technology, including things like hyperspectral scanning, airborne geophysics, handheld X-ray fluorescence chemistry, the ability of computers for data bandwidth and storing capability, enhanced processing techniques of the data and artificial intelligence to help interpret it. Another factor is huge new demand for mineral commodities are resulting from the growth of renewable energy and the need for minerals to facilitate this. The world economy is expanding, and the energy markets evolve, and so the critical minerals needed are also going to evolve. And so there is also new support at the moment. Federal programs have significantly expanded, with Alaska as a key target. And the next slides will highlight these factors that are driving technology-driven exploration.
So Dr. Warden, if you would pause for just a moment here, or Director Warden, you could be a doctor as well. I don't know.
Both.
Okay, cool. So I'm looking at the new technology, and of course, I know you're talking about minerals, and I go to natural gas and Cook Inlet. And I'm wondering if any of these type of technologies can be used to more clearly identify where gas deposits are that might be economic to develop. Can they be applied to that depth?
Yes, Chair Giesel, they can. It's not just the mineral industry that's applying these techniques, and I'll show you an example in the two slides from now where it's used in the energy industry in the North Slope, but it equally could be applied to Cook Inlet. So.
Very good. Thank you. Any other questions while we're paused here? All right. Go ahead and continue.
Okay. Slide number six. It starts in on the new technology that I'm going to highlight. The figure on the right shows a schematic of the custom designed hyperspectral core scanner we just purchased. There's very few of these in the world. And so we're trying to lead the technology advantage here. It is scheduled to arrive at our Geologic Materials Center in spring of 2025. The scanner will enable us to digitally preserve more than 500,000 feet of legacy core, and it will generate massive amounts of spectral data to interpret. This will help us leverage our roughly $50 billion worth of existing energy and mineral exploration samples at the GMC to facilitate new resource discoveries. We will use it to build machine learning data sets and provide global research access online to explorers all over the world.
Dr. Warden, Co-Chair Bishop has a question.
Thank you, Chair Giesel. This is your freshman entry-level student, Doctor. Can you expound on bullet number three for me? And this is my question. So you're not saying that we have $50 billion worth of cores in the core shack in Anchorage, are you?
Okay. Co-Chair Bishop, we have roughly that, you know, half a million feet of materials. And if we were to go out at modern, you know, current prices to go fly out to these areas all over the state and to replace them and re-drill the holes, yes, it is worth the equivalent in today's dollars is that, yes.
I just wanted to get that on the record. Thank you. Yeah. To show you that everyone the value of those who are listening at home, what's in that core shack?
Chair,
it's actually
Chair.
The Geologic Materials Center. Yes.
Chair Bishop, Chair Giesel, John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner for the record. Core shack or GMC, whatever the descriptor, that $50 billion is, we believe, a conservative number. Some of those wells were drilled long ago and were drilled at tens or hundreds of millions of dollars in at those times cost. And so some of them basically could never be recovered again. And so it's an invaluable resource, and this technology essentially allows us to preserve it and expand what we can get from it. So it's very exciting.
Thank you, sir.
Very good, if you'd continue, Dr. Warden.
Okay, now moving on to slide seven. And this is where the application to the energy that I mentioned. The figure on the right shows the first test scan of core from the Umiat well on the North Slope. And what you can see here is that the hydrocarbon signature just pops right out in blue. And our hyperspectral scanning will provide a cheaper, faster mineral identification compared to logging core by hand. It can create scalable geologic models. It can map alteration. When fluids pass through rocks, they leave alteration signatures and they change closer and farther away from ore, or from if pore space is full of carbonate in the oil drill holes, then you know that's filled up, so it's not a good place for oil. So these are vectors, and so it's both a superior pointer to mineralization and for the energy industry as well, and it can improve our reservoir quality data sets and knowledge. And this new data will help industry, including those in the oil and gas sectors, the carbon capture, utilization, and storage, the geothermal sector, mineral sector, and others who wish to use it, researchers as well. And so slide number 8. For many years, we've been flying airborne magnetic surveys, but we are also flying gamma ray spectrometry surveys. This will helps map uranium, thorium, and potassium, and it helps find favorable plutons, including those with rare earth elements associated with them. Last summer, I was really excited. I've always wanted to fly a gravity survey, and we flew our first one ever, and it maps slight variations in the Earth's gravity. And this can delineate faults, sedimentary basins, and high-density ore bodies. And we are also flying electromagnetic surveys. These map conductive rocks, geology, and we can model geology in 3 dimensions from it. It's great for picking up graphite, massive sulfide ores. They can define faults in a geothermal reservoir, and they can identify permafrost hazards. Great new technology. So on slide 9, we are also applying new technology in the geochemistry realm. This figure shows all of the historical stream sediment samples that were collected over the years by DGGS and the U.S. Geological Survey. New anomalies can be found by reanalyzing these historical samples, which were saved, and we are using modern analytical methods. In the past, the older data is missing some elements of interest, including such elements as rare earth elements and some of the critical minerals. So you can't find them unless you can analyze these samples to find new anomalies. We've finished the ones in yellow, blue, and green, and we're heading into Southwest Alaska in the Seward Peninsula. And our aim is to prioritize those areas outlined in red, which are critical mineral belts.
So a question, Dr. Worden. So these are historic cores, right? What are the chances that with the seismic events that we've had, that some of these have moved subsurface, some of these deposits have moved around? Is that likely? Does that happen?
So when the Denali Fault moved, that was one of the larger offset events. And so we flew over it and measured it. And if I remember correctly, there was like a 30-foot offset at one of the largest offset points. So through time, you build up all of those fault motions along the Denali Fault, and you can take known ore bodies, and they do get shifted in their location over time. And they're like the Tintina Fault and the Denali Fault. And so, yeah, the deposits, you know, the long history geologically of Alaska, some mineral deposits have moved. These samples, if you're referring to these samples, in our time scale of collecting them versus reanalyzing them, no.
Gotcha. All right. Thank you.
Chair Giesel, if I may, John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner, for the record, from a layperson's perspective, one of the things that's so exciting about the synthesis of this kind of data assessment that we're able to do with these new technologies is that it's kind of exactly that kind of study, both on a geologic age and as a near-term age, how the geology is responding to different kinds of data sets that show different kinds of responses, often over geologic time. And we have this new frontier of being able to collect data on a massive scale. It used to be in logbooks and paper maps. Now it's on trillion terabyte hard drives. And now we have increasing tools to synthesize it and compare it one to another and create overlays. So understanding trend changes is one of the kind of emerging syntheses that's very exciting right now, as I understand it. And I don't understand it well, so I'm learning more every day.
Cool. Thank you. Yes, Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this sort of relates to the next slide, I think, more. Talking about the partnership with the federal, I think it's USGS or the federal agencies. So when we're looking at these mineral belts, obviously they don't track with where state land is. You know, they might have some overlap there because of the way we did our land selection, but certainly these mineral deposits could end up on federal or private land. And we've been learning a lot at this committee about sort of our tax structure and our royalty structure, and given the amount of infrastructure we sort of invest when there's a project. And so if it's not on state land, obviously it doesn't, or not obviously, but sometimes it doesn't result in a lot of revenue for Alaska, although we have sometimes outlays for it. So I guess my question is, are we focused, are we only doing this on state land? Are we primarily focused on state land? And if we're doing it on private land, is there some way to share that cost with some of the private landowners?
Okay. Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, I will be getting into, in a couple slides, the Earth Mapping Resources Initiative that we have with the U.S. Geological Survey. And so... that program is for any land that's open to mineral entry. And so it doesn't matter whether it's federal, state, or native land, or private land, we can use that money for that purpose. Any state money that's allocated to us is for the state land. And then we commonly have partnerships where we have had money from Native corporations and money from industry brought in to help us do these surveys. They benefit by, well, we all benefit because we're increasing the amount of work we do, and so the cost is cheaper. So we all benefit that way. And so... And if they want more detail on their land, since we are using public funds to do this work, our requirement is that we make it publicly available. Whereas, the industry keeps most industry data private. If they want to work with us, then it has to become public, which benefits the understanding of the mineral resources of the state.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Dunbar, through the chair, John Crowther here, to interrupt. Very well stated by Director Worden. The department's very cognizant of the status of land that's assessed, and so we certainly focus. Director Worden stated on land available for mineral entry. Many federal lands are not, and so the kind of as applied suite is very focused on state lands, but other land types are not excluded. But we very much... You know, this data is not an academic exercise. It's a applied exploration enablement exercise to maximize development of resources and understanding of our resources.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I'll let you proceed.
Okay. Another thing that is driving exploration is that there is an increasing demand and there are new needs for metals. And so these, I just happened to pull off these two figures. The slide on the left shows, or the figure on the left shows, forecasted increasing demand for for the energy transition metals on the left and conventional metals on the right, projected out through 2050. And essentially, all metal needs trends go up. And, you know, you've heard that in the prior discussion as well as the need for metals. And so on slide 11, this is our new support is coming in through the Earth Mapping Resources Initiative. It's a cooperative program between the states and the United States Geological Survey to understand the geologic framework in its critical minerals focused. There are three components primarily to it. It's geophysical surveys, geologic mapping, and geochemical mapping on lands that are open to mineral entry. And it takes a mineral systems approach. We are surveying broad areas where the geology is favorable for new discoveries, and critical minerals are often found in direct association with conventional minerals, and so understanding the entire system is important. Slide number 12. This new support has enabled us to expand the footprint of what we do. DGGS has a long-running program to geophysically survey Alaska's mineral belts in the green areas there from the early 1990s to 2020. This new Earth MRI program has increased the rate and quality of surveying dramatically, allowing us in just a couple of years to cover an entire mineral belt in orange. And the bipartisan infrastructure law gave a major boost to the Earth MRI program for a five-year window to increase the rate at which we can provide these valuable data layers for Alaska's mineral belts. Slide 13. And so we're currently working on the Kuskokwim mineral belt. In 2022, DGGS completed geophysical surveying of the Yukon-Tanana uplands area, which goes from the Yukon border all the way to Manling Hot Springs. And now we're systematically surveying the Kuskokwim mineral belt, stretching from Manly Hot Springs down through McGrath, out to Bethel and Dillingham. And this highly mineralized area includes the Donlin Gold Project and the Nixon Fork and Illinois Creek mines that were historical mines. It's an area of high industry interest and has high potential for both gold and many critical minerals out in this belt. And
Senator Klayman, a question?
Just a geography question to the chair. The Kuskokwim mineral belt, is that showing up on, is that easily identified in one of the areas on slide 12, or is that somewhere else on slide 12 with the statewide map?
Through the chair, Senator Klayman. So the on this figure, perfect, thank you. And it's the one on the left there with the hand on it. That is the Kuskokwim belt, and then off up to the right in the figure is the Yukon-Tanana uplands there.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. It's just different colors, so it was hard to read.
Yes, yes. And so then, so we're going to zoom in on figure 13. And we'll go to slide 14 is zoomed in. And this shows our new aeromagnetic data from the 2023 survey in the Kuskokwim mineral belt. This data shows two suites of plutons. The red equals a magnetic high, and these are often copper gold prospects. And the blue are magnetic lows, and they're often associated with tin silver prospects, and both of these have other critical minerals associated with them. The important thing about this is we can literally draw circles around and these systems and say, industry, go here, go here, go here, and this will create new exploration plays, and they're clearly highlighted by this data, and we expect staking and investment to follow because of this.
So, Dr. Warden, clarification, it says aeromagnetic, so you overflew these areas.
Yes. To create this figure, mm-hmm. Chair Giesel, to create this figure, we put a magnetometer aboard a fixed-wing aircraft, sometimes if it's mountainous, a helicopter. And then to create this figure here, you fly back and forth all summer, and it's created. This is like we collect about 40 data points a second as we're flying back and forth, and then it builds up this figure, and then the data is processed and leveled and make sure it's nice and clean, and then put this out as a product.
Very nice. Thank you.
Chair Giesel, Deputy Commissioner, again, offering layperson commentary, so always defer to the doctor for the details. But, you know, I mean, this the level of data gathering that this represents is kind of inconceivable in the pre-high data bandwidth, high data collection era. This would be a lifetime or longer of work by someone having a deep intermeshed understanding of a single area that they might devote a career or a series of careers to. And now we can fly over it in a season or two, have a massive data dump, and then dozens of prospectors or hundreds all around the world can look at the same data and apply different perspectives they have. So it's a paradigm shift in the scope and scale of data that's available.
Senator Klayman.
Just so I'm tracking what you're doing from an airplane many years ago in a time far, far away, I was going on a grid with every 50 feet pushing a button on a magnetometer. And so if you jump ahead, I guess, 40 some odd years, you're essentially doing what I was doing with a button on a magnetometer every 50 feet and now doing that from an airplane with a greater, more frequent marks as you go over. Yep. I mean, but you're essentially gathering the same data. It's just much more detailed data than I was getting with the magnetometer. Or with, it's still a magnetometer, but whatever the box I was pushing the button on, it's nowhere near the sophistication you're using today.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Klayman, yes, they used to like look out the window and put a dot on a map to guess roughly where they were located. That was the way we started this with the magnetometer on board, and then now it's everything's digitally GPS radar to, you know, in three dimensions, you know exactly where you are. And it's, yeah, it's like 40 hertz or 40 readings per second as you're flying.
Follow?
Yes, follow up, Senator Klayman.
So from what I was doing on the ground with standing and putting the box, pushing the button, the next step was in an airplane with a button and you put with a box that you pushed a button and now they just have it on and they keep reading.
Yes.
I feel a lot older than I did when I came.
Let's not emphasize that. All right. I'll let you proceed.
Okay. In slide 15, we are also geologically mapping. And we are currently mapping in the most active mineral belt in Alaska, the Yukon-Tanana upland there between Fairbanks and the Yukon border and north of the Alaska Range. It has four operating lode mines, numerous placer mines, and many exploration projects. The enhanced funding from Earth MRI allows mapping of this entire belt. Geologic mapping is a very labor-intensive process. But technology advances in chemistry and airborne geophysics allow geologists to geologically map Alaska's mineral belts much better than before. And I'll show you that as an example in the next slide, which is number 16. This figure shows our advancements. The figure on the left was made in the 1960s, and it's full of question marks, and they didn't really go to a lot of places. And the map on the right shows our new, much more detailed geologic mapping, which was informed by the geophysical data interpretations. Many new faults were discovered, and geologic units are much better characterized, which helps better understand the area's mineral potential. It suggests new types of mineral deposits based on the geology that's there that you wouldn't have known that it was a possibility in this region. And so in slide number 17, and this is an example of the results. And so DGGS's geophysical surveys and geologic mapping helped drive industry exploration interest and success in the Bonnefield District. And this chart really maps each time that we did a data release, the number of claims went up. And so the result was international investment, drilling, and they made numerous new discoveries. And the staking of claims generates revenue for the state. And the last slide here is slide number 18. All jurisdictions that want to be globally competitive in attracting industry investment provide these regional scale geoscience data sets. New data sets mean new opportunities for industry to identify exploration targets in Alaska, utilizing modern tools such as artificial intelligence. Providing more data sets increases Alaska's worldwide favorability ranking and then builds our reputation. We fortunately enjoy very favorable rankings in the industry standard Fraser Institute survey, and more data will help us maintain increase our ranking. And thank you very much. And if you have any other questions.
Yes, Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, kind of going back to the discussion we were having about the flying the magnetometer and the automated sampling, I would suspect, or I guess check me on this, so is like the amplitude being data, is the data being corrected for like distance to the ground? So is there like a constant correction to reconcile that data? So I'm just picturing this is it, the resolution of it gets becomes pretty wonderful, not only with the frequency of the data sampled, but also if it's constantly correcting for the relative distance from the terrain.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Kaufman, yes. I think that it's called pitch, yaw, and roll in aircrafts. There's corrections for all of those, and there's two measurements to the ground with traditional radar, and then you can do it with LIDAR and distance measuring. And so it is important to maintain a constant elevation above the topography so that your the instrument to ground distance is maintained to be the same as well. There are corrections you can apply, but you start with the most optimized, they call it draping the surface.
Follow up?
Yes, thanks. Through the chair. Yeah, and that's where I picked up on that from the comment about the type of aircraft. So if you have a lot of terrain following you have to do, you're doing it with a helicopter. But I was just picturing, you know, within that, the potential for tightening up that data even further. So thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. A couple questions. How much is spent on a yearly basis to obtain this information that we just saw the presentation on? That's number one. Number two is, what lands are chosen to survey? Is it unleased lands? Is it leased lands? And then the third question is, how is the information released? Is there a fee that's charged? Is it just in the public domain?
Okay, through the chair, Senator Wilikowski. I'll start with the last one because that's the easy one. It's free. Anybody can download it from our website for free. And can you remind me what the other question
is? Yeah, I'm just curious what your spend is on a yearly basis, number one. And then the second one is, how do you choose which lands to survey? Is there, and are you surveying or existing leased area, or are you surveying just areas that you think might be prospective?
Okay, so we are flying the mineral belts as defined in that one of the first figures. We're restricting it to where the land is open to mineral entry. I know there are a couple areas in Alaska where there's mineral leases, but generally it's on a claim staking basis. People fly with a helicopter, stake the claims around the ground, and pay fees for that. As to what we spend, this is on a annual basis. We have increased our funding dramatically because of the Earth Mapping Resources Initiative program. If I remember correctly, last year the federal portion was $5.825 million, and I think the state side for the, they request a 25% match, it was roughly $2.75 million.
Follow up, Senator Wilkowski?
Yeah, and it, so it was a little unclear to me. Are you surveying land that's already staked or that's already leased out to be mined?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, we go across this land. Some of it may be staked, and we do outreach to anybody who has claims staked out there to, hey, would you like to participate and contribute to, well, we're flying over your land to tighten up the line spacing. But, you know, we don't stop and leave holes. We just create a continuous data set so it's nice and clean.
Then one last question.
Yes, follow up, Senator Wilkowski.
Is it typical that in other jurisdictions for this information to be free, or is there some sort of recoupment if a company comes in and maybe finds a huge amount of minerals, or is there a fee in other jurisdictions?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, to my knowledge, this is typically given away for free because it's an enticement to bring industry here. And there are studies in Australia and Canada where there's a demonstrated return on the investment that's many times that initially invested. So that's how you attract the industry jobs, you attract the exploration, the claim staking, and that process is where the payback is.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, that's a really interesting point. I think you said Canada and Australia, those are the two countries, or Australia and a different one, right?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, those are the most parallel jurisdictions that we either strive to achieve their results. Australia is pretty amazing. They have full coverage with geophysics at the regional scale, and they're going in and doing many more types in more detail. And there are some differences in the jurisdiction. And so that's one we can, you know, as a state, look at those differences and how we could try to benefit our state through those.
Follow up, Madam
Chair.
Yes,
follow up, Senator.
So you're talking about return on investment, and you know, what are the revenue structures in those two states and those two countries? You know, do they have an income tax? Do they have a sales tax? Do they have other ways to capture revenue from those things? And when we look at return on investment for Alaska, you know, is it similar? Are we capturing revenue in the way that Australia is? I genuinely don't know, but you know, their calculations presumably include some way to capture revenue, right?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, that's actually starting outside of my area of expertise, and the Division of Mine, Land and Water has the revenue component of what the mineral industry comes in with. Our agency is strictly to generate this data to attract industry to come. So perhaps we could get back to you on that.
Yeah, Representative Dunbar, John Crowther, for the record, through the chair. We can work to give a quick summary. I mean, I don't want to represent the department as having expertise in the mineral revenue regimes in those countries or the land statuses, but we can do some summary research and provide that to the committee.
Yeah, brief follow-up, Madam Chair.
Follow-up, Senator Dunbar.
I think it's an interesting way to look at the calculation, right? Because you say, okay, this is how much investment Australia made, and this is what their return on investment is. But first of all, a lot of the largest companies that come in and do this work aren't based in Alaska. So if there are profits generated, they might stay in Australia the way they don't stay in Alaska. But even beyond that, I would like some analysis of it. I know it's Department of Revenue, and it's always this challenge. We have Department of Revenue in front of us, and they say, well, that's a DNR question. DNR in front of it is a Department of Revenue question. But, you know, I just don't think the economics work the same way in Alaska, where even if we attract and retain workers, and we're paying for schools, and we're paying for roads, and we're paying for other things, you know, are we able to capture revenue for this or any industry in the way that those other states that, you know, we are most analogous to are doing? So yeah, any kind of analysis to that end that you could supply Director Crowther would be appreciated. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Further questions? Okay, I'm going to follow up on Senator Dunbar and Senator Wilikowski's question, because I'm critically interested in that subject as well. Investment, but I'm interested in the investment in our people. So you're probably familiar with Alaska Resource Education. It's a nonprofit. They go into the schools and they talk about the opportunities in our resource resource industry in terms of jobs, future jobs, right? And so I'm looking at you, Dr. Werther, and I'm thinking, I'm mispronouncing your name. But in any case, I'm looking at you, and I know that Alaska Resource Education has a program specifically targeting young women in high school in these industries. I'm looking at this technology, and I'm thinking, what high school kid would not be interested in this? What do you do? Do you ever have opportunity to speak to young people? We have young people leaving our state and not coming back. You could offer them tremendous opportunity, exciting stuff to do. Do you ever have opportunity to do that?
Chair Giesel, yes. We, as in our agency, when there's school kid talk opportunities, we go do that. There's a worldwide shortage of geophysicists right now. Encourage everybody, you know, to please study physics and math. And it's a really great opportunity. And it's really neat stuff in my biased opinion here of what we do. And, you know, we have to the point of there's such a shortage that we bring people in-house and have had to train them on staff to meet our state needs for doing this.
I completely believe you. As Senator Klayman noted, some of us are aging. Not many of us, but you must be experiencing that also in your staff as people reach retirement age and you're losing a wealth of information. We've got to replace that with our young people. That's an investment and a return that we can realize here. That's not just dollars and cents, but actual people living here, loving living here, growing up here. And I just thank you for speaking to young people. I have a granddaughter. My second oldest granddaughter has an interest in being a geologist. So that's really cool, and I encourage her, but she's moved to Dayton, Ohio. So those kind of kids we need to keep here. We need to invest here. So thank you for what you're doing. This was a great presentation, and I am hoping this gets spread around to some high schools.
Senator
Rother.
Chair Giesel, I flipped here to our closing slide, which has Melanie's contact information. I would note Melanie in her efforts to recruit talented geoscientists to Alaska, I believe, has called every geoscientist professor in the United States, advertising our opportunities. And so whether you're a high school student, whether you're a graduate student, whether you're looking for a second career, if you are interested, we would like to talk to you. And Melanie would probably like to talk to you directly.
Yes.
So.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, that specific instance, I had difficulty finding a geophysicist. So yes, I emailed every single geophysics professor in the U.S. and Canada trying to get them to get a student to come work for us. So,
were you successful?
Not directly through that effort, but during that particular recruitment, yes, thankfully.
That's great. Good. Yeah. Good. All right. Any other questions from committee members? No. All right. Well, thank you very much, very much for this presentation. Very exciting stuff. All right. So this concludes our meeting. The next meeting is Wednesday, April 17th at 3:30. On the agenda will be a presentation from the Alaska Hydrogen Working Group. So this is a very cool working group out of the Alaska Center for Energy and Power. They meet monthly. I enjoy the meetings very much, and we will have the Department of Energy, U.S. Department of Energy, leading that discussion. So that's on Wednesday. So at this time, the meeting is adjourned. Let the record reflect. The time is 4:38 p.m.